who are refusing and rejecting this behavior, this political behavior. But now they have really to open their eyes to the new realities. The Palestinians are not going to allow anybody to silence them, to shove their legitimate rights under the table, and talk to the Israelis as if life is normal. Life is not normal in Palestine, and the sooner these leaders wake up to this new reality, the better chance they have to reconcile with their own people. It's not only with the Palestinians, it's with their own people. Otherwise, they are just betting on a losing horse that is not going to take them. Israel had shown that it cannot even protect itself. How is she going to protect these regimes who are normalizing their relationship?
Thank you. The war in Palestine has led to large protests in the British capital, with thousands gathering outside the Israeli embassy in West London to slam the atrocities being perpetrated by the Israeli military. Ayn Islam spoke to some of those who attended.
We are very saddened by what the British government has done, calling for an unequivocal support for Israel, who is an occupying power violating international law and has put the people of Palestinians under siege. We condemn this in the strongest terms, and we call upon them to rescind their one-sided support for Israel and become an honest broker and try and bring the two sides together towards peace.
I want to send my support to the Palestinians who are still resisting and still occupying new territory in Palestine and inspiring the world with what's possible. The success of Palestinian resistance is it makes me emotional to even talk about it. I'm so happy to be here and see so many other people who are similarly inspired.
Palestine has a right to resist. It doesn't matter what they do, they have a right to resist. And anyone who opposes that are either ignorant of international law or are just bigoted. It's one rule for the oppressor and the occupier, and another rule for the oppressed and the occupied. So that's that, as far as I'm concerned. So then the question is, well, what about people like Rishi Sunak, Sadiq Khan, who are lighting up our government offices with the flag of the occupier? That is a political statement. That's a political move. And anything they say around that is just bluster. Muslims need to realize that if our opponents, the occupiers of Palestinian homes and lands, if they're going to pull a political move, Muslims need to pull a political move as well. So what I'm here today, inshallah, is to help bring out people to help us with our campaign for the general election, inshallah, next year.
We have to send a strong message to the whole world that the British government doesn't speak for us. And we in the UK have to do everything in our power to disrupt this relationship. The British government willingness to stand by as Israel calls for new waves of war crimes, completely in violation of the Geneva Accords, which both Israel and the UK are signatories to, is appalling. But right now is a time for celebration. The steadfast resistance has given us so much to be proud of and so much to aspire to in our own lives. We all have a duty to resist as fiercely as Palestinians resist.
Because I believe Zionism is wrong. I'm an anti-Zionist, and I believe the occupation of Israel, the occupation of Palestine isn't good. Don't cry, you'll be free. You'll be free one day, inshallah.
Now, Karim, propaganda is a well-documented tool in any war. What do you make of the overwhelming push in the UK to paint Palestinian civilians and resistance fighters as terrorists?
I think the equation of resistance with terrorism, as well as the labeling of Palestinians as human animals, for example, is disgusting and deplorable dehumanizing language that is deliberately used to justify acts of terror against the Palestinians, whether it's war crimes such as cutting off water, energy, food supplies to Gaza, as well as encouraging, as well as when the occupiers take that stance, they encourage their allies to join them in that far-reaching goalpost, which at that point then gives Israel the justification and the support they need from the international community to continue to act with impunity.
Now, I do want to ask a question to yourself, Doctor, and it's in particular, you know, you said that there's been a shift. Now, does this operation signify a major shift in regards to history, you know, going forward? Are we going to look back on this and say this was a major turning point in the occupation and also regionally as well, the balance of power? I've heard many people talk about, oh, this is a change in the balance of power. Is it really going to see a change in the future?
I believe it is. This battle have shown for the first time that the Palestinians can stand up, fight for themselves, and be victorious. All the previous battles have been either attacks on the Palestinians without really being able to defend themselves, or it has been fought on behalf of the Palestinians by some Arab states that has abandoned them at the end of the day when they regained their own territory. So this is the first time that the Palestinians have been able to fight an army that is considered one of the strongest armies in the world after the superpowers, and defeat it and enter the occupied territories. And we know all what has happened since then, taking the prisoners of war and some hostages and so on, and inflicting such a heavy loss on their enemy. So all this shows that there is really a change in the power in Palestine itself. Israel can commit atrocities, can attack civilians in Gaza, can deprive 2.25 million people of water and medicine and food, as they have declared, their defense minister have declared. But none of this is going to change the fact that Israel has been defeated by the Palestinians themselves for the first time.
Now, we know that there's long been, you know, attempts to both conflate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism and at the same time dehumanize the Palestinian people. And then as a result of that, we've been seeing, you know, very one-sided narratives coming forward in the West, in the UK and elsewhere, and in particular in the UK. You know, just in the past few days, we've been seeing people being arrested just for waving Palestinian flags on the order of the Home Secretary. Now, what can Muslims and others in the UK do in their professional and online capacities to support Palestine? And what kind of legal support can they get?
Thank you. So to answer the question of what kind of legal support can pro-Palestinian activists or professionals receive, it's the moment that you understand or feel that you are being targeted, harassed, or bullied, you should reach out for legal help. The Islamic Human Rights Commission is one such organization that provides this sort of advice and assistance to individuals. I think perhaps on a broader scale, the Muslim community and other pro-Palestinian communities, activist groups, can come together for is a legal fighting fund that will provide a war chest to repel accusations that are slanderous and libellous and defamatory with respect to labels of anti-Semitism and so on and so forth. I just want to provide my own analysis at the moment as to what is going on in the UK regarding pro-Palestinian censorship, if I may. It's done in several ways, in particular through three prongs, from what I understand. Those are through criminalization, which we've touched upon, lawfare, and policy. Now, they're all very related. They're all very much related, but they're also interlinked with their own separate methodologies and priorities. So in the instance of criminalization, for example, we have the idea of scaremongering ordinary citizens into the idea that showing support for Palestine through a chant or indeed waving a flag is going to be a criminal offense that is, in Suella Braverman's estimation and understanding, equal to terrorism or amounting to support for terrorism. And this is only meant to be exercised in certain contexts, but when you have police officers who are the arbiters of that discretion of what is that context, then we really have to ask questions of, are they really equipped here to deal with this sort of matter, or is it...
That's more an attempt to try to silence rather than actually arresting people, right? It's more to intimidate and to have a chilling effect on people's free speech.
That's correct, and it can lead on to arrest. As we saw yesterday, as you did mention, there was a young man in Manchester who stood near a pro-Israeli demonstration with a Palestinian flag on his back and was removed and detained by police along with three others. In a now deleted tweet by Greater Manchester Police, they stated that they were not arrested for flying the Palestinian flag, but really it was a public order offense. That tweet has obviously, as I mentioned, been deleted, and it's very unclear as to what exactly happened and under which powers those individuals were brought to action. Moving forward, if I may, or if you have another question, Issa, then please, I don't want to stop you.
No. I was actually just about to say, unfortunately, that's all that we have time for today. But I wanted to thank you, Karim Ali, for your time. And also, of course, Dr. Hossein Shahristani as well for joining us in the studio today for this really important and I think historical time in history as we look at what is happening in Palestine. Again, thank you. You can join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab, your host of Islamic Upbringing, the show that guides you on how to nurture your children in the light of Islam. We welcome your questions and concerns on this topic, and we have experts who will guide you with the solutions based on the Noble Quran and the teachings of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to be with Brother Miqdad again. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you, and thank you too, and salam to all the listeners.
Well, Brother Miqdad, there's a concern with so many parents. There was a time when, parents would say, not giving a mobile phone or a device in the hands of children is the best way to keep them away from the, negative views of it. But as the coronavirus came in some years ago, and then there were online classes, and then parents were compelled to give their children the devices, and now there are hardly any children who don't have the devices. But the concern of parents is raising. Now, we have a question. How much should I monitor my child's device?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, as you mentioned quite clearly, device and the mobile phone in the hands of children is a very difficult challenge. And it's a challenge that we're facing today. And we won't know the effects of this danger for in the next 10 years. That's when everything will become clear for us, that how much damage that caused the new generation that's growing up in this world where they have mobile phones from a very, very young age. So it's important that parents are aware of this. Parents are taking care and taking the right measures and the right steps to equip their children with the right tools to be able to deal with this, because we don't live in a time where we can avoid it. How much we can try to reduce it, we can try to do damage control as much as we can by reducing it, and we should definitely. But at the same time, we need to realize that it's there to stay, and so we have to navigate around it, equip ourselves with the tools to be able to deal with it. So a couple of points regarding this. The first one is that, as I mentioned, as a first principle, is to reduce as much as possible, right? As much as you can delay it,
right.
Delay it. There's no need for a two-year-old or three-year-old to be using a phone so often, or even owning a phone, as a matter of fact. So as much as we can, delay it. It is possible for young children to be kept busy, to be kept playing different things. They can be enjoying playing with the different toys and different friends without necessarily spending a lot of time on the screen. So, similarly with older kids as well, so 5, 6, it's perhaps not necessary for them to own a smartphone, for example. They can have one of those old phones that doesn't have any apps on them,
right.
That isn't going to internet. If you really need to stay in touch with your kids, you can give them one of those old phones. Teaching them the purpose behind it, which I'll mention in a second. So, as a first principle, a first reminder for us is to, if it's possible, or as much as possible, to delay them having this gadget in their hands.
Right. So, dear listeners, you're listening to Islamic Upbringing, a show that mentors you on how to cultivate your children in accordance with Islam. We are taking a short break right now. We'll be resuming back soon with more on this show, so stay tuned.
Wait, stop! I got a better game!
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys, one is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5, and they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry, we're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic Upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Brother Miqdad, and we're discussing some of the key points for parents, how they can control when the children are dealing with the devices. So, Brother Miqdad, the first point that you mentioned is to delay it as much as possible.
The second point is to teach children to use the mobile phone with a purpose. This is very important and something we need to learn as well, perhaps. I guess many of us don't use a phone
with purpose.
With purpose, right? We use it as leisure. We use it as just to kind of scroll and just be fed with things. Just be fed with things randomly without any particular purpose in mind. So as much as you can, you teach your children that when you pick up the phone, when you pick up the laptop, you're doing something specific. And you, throughout the journey of doing this, you do not get distracted by what's around you.
Right.
So there'll be things around you, whether this looks interesting, that looks interesting, there's an advert that just come up, I can click on that. We need to train our children and ourselves that whenever I pick up the phone, for example, I'm going to make a call or I'm going to do a particular internet search, for example, about a particular word, then I'm not going to get distracted about who messaged me right now or what's happening in the world, in the news. I can check this feed and I can click on this advert. And this is very important. So, for example, when I mentioned before the break to give your child a phone that's not a smartphone, you teach them, for example, that right now all you need is for me to be in contact with you. For example, I need to pick you up somewhere or you're going somewhere on your own, therefore we need to be in touch. So all you need is a device that will give you text messages and phone, right? That's all you need to do. And therefore, there's no need because that's the purpose behind it. Whenever you are in need of a phone that has an app and you have particular need for that, then we can upgrade to that. So you're teaching them to use the phone with a purpose. And this is very, very important. If a child really is able to navigate through the different distractions and the adverts and really focus on why we're using the phone. So even later, when you teach them, for example, when you're playing with the phone, let's say you've kept an hour, half an hour per day to play on the phone or to play on the laptop, for example, then again, same thing, you teach them, you've got a purpose. The purpose is to play, right? So here you go, from this time to this time you're playing, you've got the phone in your hand. Use it to do what you're supposed to do. This is the game you're supposed to be playing. Play this game. Avoid the adverts. Don't just get distracted by the different things that are happening around that.
Right. Unfortunately, the apps, the social media platforms are designed the way that it makes even the adults addicted to itself. So, but you're saying like before into getting into the apps itself, the entire device should be used with purpose. Even it's important for parents because when parents do that, children learn from actions more than that they learn from the words. Well, dear listeners, we have a lot more to explore on this topic here with Brother McThought, but we'll do that after a short break. So do not dare to change that dial. We'll be back in a while after a short break.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said, Honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Brother McDowell and we're discussing some of the key points for parents to control the children when they have devices in their hands. So the first thing that Brother McDowell said was to delay this device as much as possible. And if possible, try to give them old phones than the smartphones. And then the second point he said was that use devices with purpose yourself and also teach your children to use the devices with purpose.
Third point is to avoid, if possible, making a child owner of a phone. So this is an important point. It applies for the phone as well as a laptop and a tablet, etc. Wherever possible, the gadget should be a family gadget, right? It should be a family phone. It should be a family laptop.
Right.
And as such, children don't feel that they have the right to go, for example, in their room and do whatever they want with the phone.
Right.
Behind locked doors. No. It should be at the access of everyone. If mommy wants to come and check what's on the phone, she's allowed to come and check. So it's there to be used by the child. He can use it whenever he wants. If he goes out, for example, because he has a purpose to keep the phone in him, because he needs to be in touch with his parents, for example, mm-hmm. he takes the phone and goes with it.
Right.
Or he needs to make a phone call, he needs to stay in touch with his friends, he can use the phone. But the approach that should be there should be that you can use it, but it doesn't necessarily belong to you. It's a family phone, basically. Right. Same with the laptop as well. It's a family laptop. It needs to stay in the lounge, for example, in the sitting room, in the living room, where it's accessible to everyone. And if parents come and want to use it, the child shouldn't feel like, why are you using my phone? Why are you spying on me? It's mine. You're not allowed to take it.
Right.
Obviously, this at some point, this will change as children have this sense of independency and secrecy and being kind of having their own things, which happen close to teenagehood.
Right.
But before that, as much as possible, avoid them having a sense of ownership over it.
Right.
And keeping things as belonging to the family, accessible to the whole family, being not behind closed doors, ensures that they are obviously they themselves will be more careful about how they use it. Parents will have a bit more access and be able to monitor what the child is doing, and therefore kind of avoid any accidents, avoid the child misusing the device and the gadget.
Right.
Regarding this, you might find that some children might turn around and say that, but how come mommy and dad have
the authority
their
to
own
use.
Phones? Yeah, how come they have ownership? In that case, you can explain to them, look, parents might be different from their children, right? They require their phone for certain purposes that means that they can't be accessible to the children, for example. It's important to make a distinction between children and parents. And children should understand that I'm a child and I have parents as well. And they don't have the not necessarily all the rules that apply to my parents apply to me as a child. That's important. But obviously, with understanding, with respect, with kindness, with love, and then their children will pick it up that my parents can have their own phone, but we have family phones as well. When it comes to brothers as well, same thing again. If you really have to have two phones for both the brothers and the sisters, for example, three phones, depending on how many children you have, then that's fine as well, but same rule applies. It doesn't have to be one. Each child can be using one phone, but it does the perspective to it should be like, it doesn't necessarily belong to them. Sometimes right. They can swap it around, or it should be kept in there. It's also where you keep the phone as well. It doesn't always have to stay under the pillow, for example. It should be in the lounge, for example, on the dining table, somewhere in a common space.
Accessible
to everyone and be counted as a family phone.
Right. Thank you so much, Brother McDowell, for those beautiful points for parents who are concerned about the children who have devices in their hands now. So thank you so much, our listeners, for listening. We hope these points will help you and you'll apply them while you're parenting. Thank you so much for listening. You were listening to Islamic Upbringing from IRIB English Radio. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wa Allahu akbar.
Date February 11th, 1983.
the mischievous elements. They joined hands with the enemies of Islam, who were either their colleagues or their masters. Consequently, peace and tranquility has been established by the grace of Allah. It is necessary that the great, faithful, and Islamic nation undertake the reconstruction of the shortcomings that are the essentials of all revolutions. In the Iran Revolution, that relied on the infinite power of the exalted truth and the lofty motivation of the great strata of the nation, the losses in comparison with other great revolutions was lesser, while its achievements was greater.
A'udhu billah min ash-shaytan rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. Well, about the concept of martyrdom and the martyr, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, martyrdom has been the pride of the awliya. It is our pride as well. Well, this sentence of Imam rahmatullah alayhi is about martyrdom and its high value. The concept of martyrdom, like all other Islamic concepts, can be fully and totally appreciated only in the light of the Islamic doctrine of Tawheed, or the absolute unity of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and full submission to His will. In fact, there is no martyrdom without struggle in the cause of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and for the cause of the truth. A shaheed's proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is explained in the Holy Book of Quran as follows. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Wa la tahsabanna alladhina qutilu fi sabilillah amwatan bal ahya'un 'inda rabbihim yurzaqun. Do not think of those who are slain in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as dead. Nay, they are alive with their Lord and are provided sustenance by Him. When Islam wants to elevate the position of a person or a deed, it compares that person or deed with the position of a shaheed. For example, to show the importance of seeking knowledge, a hadith says that if someone becomes a student with the intention of finding the truth and serving his Lord, and then dies while studying, he is considered as a shaheed. This expression manifests the sanctity and excellence of a student. Likewise, a hadith praising a person who strives hard to provide the sustenance for his family says, "The one who strives hard for his family is like a fighter in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala." So you see that Imam Khomeini here is talking about the pride and respect that a martyr in Islam enjoys for himself or herself. You see that the value and the level is so high that everything is compared to be like a shaheed, not the same, but like a shaheed. And you know, that's quite precious. And that is, in fact, what Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, is talking about. Okay, dear listeners, that's the time we've got for today's episode. For ending, let's just recite the sentence of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, about martyrdom and the martyr. In that regard, he said, martyrdom has been the pride of the awliya. It is our pride as well. Thank you very much for listening to us. Until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Conversation.
Hi, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we look at Operation Banner, the name attributed to the British Army's role during the conflict between 1969 until it officially ended in 2007. My next guest served in various units of the British Army during this period and later became a member of Veterans for Peace. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildernew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh, South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and Chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's guest is Glenn Bradley. Glenn is a former British soldier who later became an officer in the Ulster Unionist Party, participating in the talks that led to the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. Glenn continues to engage in various initiatives to advance peace, reconciliation, and evolve political thinking on the island of Ireland. Glenn Bradley, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gar Milimiaga.
Glenn, you grew up on the Shankill Road, not far from where we're actually sitting right now. Can you tell us a bit about your childhood?
First thing is, if I'd said I grew up on the Shankill Road, my granny would have beat me. I grew up on the Woodvale Road, which is the top end of the Shankill. I was born in 1967 into a left-leaning, socialist-leaning, working-class family in a poverty-stricken street, two up, two down, terraced house, tin bath on the wall, no running hot water. My inheritance in life was that I was born into a loyal Irish family. What do I mean by loyal Irish? I mean that we looked eastwards for our sovereignty. We were the Irish dimension along with Welsh, English and Scots that made up the British nation, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And that is the politic that I was born into, a very hearthly home, but where politics was daily discussed, largely as a consequence of the poverty that surrounded us all. Poverty reigned in the area. Obviously, being born in 1967, it was also on the cusp of the civil uprising that was happening here in Northern Ireland. And while I had nothing to do with the previous 50 years of the Orange State and what had happened, I certainly was born into that era of violence and, in actual fact, until the ceasefires of 1994 and 1997, I knew only violence in my life. So I grew up with daily armed violence all around me on an everyday basis. You know, our days were spent listening to bombs, listening to gunfire, armed patrols on the street, para-aggression, provisional IRA aggression against my community, loyalist paramilitary violence against my community every single day on our streets.
So what motivated you then, Glenn, to join the British Army? I too grew up in a very political house and politics was discussed daily as well. We also would have understood poverty, mm-hmm. but equality and opportunities and things like that were what we were talking about. It was how we were treated compared to our neighbours a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. As far as I was concerned, I had grown up in a community that was under physical attack by the IRA. You know, day and daily, it was armed aggression against my community, and we were being failed by the RUC. We were being failed by the British Army. And in 1972, age five, I was injured in an IRA no warning car bomb. And in that small community that I come from, we knew lots of people who were getting injured. We knew lots of people who were getting killed. And it really came to a head for me on the day that Bobby Sands died. When Bobby died during that May period, you know, I was attending the Belfast Boys Model School, and our school bus was returning, and Nationalists and Republicans had formed a gauntlet at the Ardoyne roundabout, and they petrol-bombed our school bus. And there was lots of derogatory language being shouted, you know, burn you hun this, and so on and so forth. And but for the bravery of the bus driver on the day, who put his foot to the accelerator and actually mounted the Ardoyne roundabout and got us to the relative safety of Woodville Road, you know, the casualties would have been far higher. But it's the first day that I remember seething hatred in me. You know, I get off that bus and looking back up towards the roundabout, you know, my thought was, I'm going to kill yous. I am going to kill yous. And I was 14 years of age. And there's hundreds of thousands of other people would have joined the British Army without this motivation, but my motivation as a 16-year-old was quite naive at the time. You know, I was a kid who had grown up in a very closeted and tight-knit community, who was sectarian in my thinking, who believed that the Northern Ireland conflict was wholly and solely about my community and getting raped by IRA violence. And I felt that the only way that violence could be stopped was to be met by other violence. And then I naively joined the British Army thinking, I'll get the best training possible and go back to Northern Ireland and take the fight to the enemy. At 16 years of age. The British Army is one of three armies in the world that recruits children into its ranks, and it is entirely legal for 16-year-olds, even now, today in 2023, I'm talking 1984, but a child of age 16 can join the British Army.
So you joined the British Army. I mean, what was the first regiment to join? Because I understand you were in various regiments.
Yeah. I initially enlisted into the Parachute Regiment, but I also served with the Royal Irish Rangers, 1st Battalion of the Royal Irish Rangers, and I also did special duty tours during Operation Banner, which would be specific to my deployments in Northern Ireland. I actually did five tours in Northern Ireland.
So, Glenn, you said you joined the British Army to get the best training. Does that mean you had an urge to join a loyalist paramilitary group, or is that what you were thinking?
As a teenager, there is no doubt that I considered joining the 1st Battalion of the Ulster Volunteer Force, the UVF, which would be a loyalist paramilitary group. You know, I come from a family that is steeped in the tradition of the UVF, and it would have been very easy, particularly with the area that I live in, for me to join B Company. But my uncle, who was a local politician at the time in the Progressive Unionist Party, put the vibes out to make sure that if I approached anyone, which I tried to do, that I would be declined the offer to enlist into the UVF. And so, yes, enlisting into a paramilitary, loyalist paramilitary, did cross my mind. But it wasn't a viable option for me because concerned relatives made sure that that course of action that would only lead to death or prison wasn't available to me. You know, that the army was the lesser of two evils, so to speak, and I was encouraged to join the British Army.
You joined the British Army. Just cut forward and on a little bit. You then, when you retired from the army, you joined the Ulster Unionist Party.
For me, the murder of my uncle, D.C. Louis Robinson, in September 1990, played heavily on me. You know, that was within our tactical area of responsibility. The 2nd Battalion, the Royal Irish Rangers, were serving as ARB, and Louis was abducted in their area. So there I was.
Do you just want to tell a bit about that, Glenn?
My uncle was Detective Constable Louis Robinson of the RUC. He had been fishing down in County Kerry was coming back home, crossing the border, when the IRA, posing as UDR soldiers, abducted him. They held him for 3 days, torturing him, before hooding him and executing him. And that all happened within the TAOR of the regiment that I was in, the Royal Irish Rangers at that time. And I assisted in the search operation to try to locate his body. I wouldn't have said it was a catalytic moment that made me get out of the army, because I went on to do a further 4 years. But there was it, and then I did a six-month tour in Bosnia in 1992. And I think the combination of both those, I was evolving from believing that violence could satisfy things, and I was moving into a reality for me where I believed that violence was futile. And I left the army because of that in 1994.
And then, so you joined the Ulster Unionist Party at that stage then?
Yeah.
Hopes for peace or what?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, but by this stage, I'd gone from being a naive kid who worshipped at the high altar of violence to someone who believed that dialogue, engagement, equitable equality were the only things that could resolve the political situation in Northern Ireland. So I landed back here in 1994, back to the Woodfield, the area that I came from, and there was no change. There was no change from 1984 to 1984 on the poverty or anything. Nothing was being addressed. It was still the usual fly or traipse a Union Jack over a donkey and put it up for an election that would get election. And I said, this can't continue. So I initially, again, funny enough, was going to join the Progressive Unionist Party. But my uncle felt that because of my army service, I would never be trusted. And he said, you'd be better off going into the UUP and you'd probably get further on politically than what you could. So I joined the Ulster Unionist Party. So my motivation at the Good Friday Agreement was to get a peace accord on which we could then build to create equitable equality and address all the imbalances that, in my view, had made Northern Ireland unworkable up to that point. So that was my motivation in being in the Ulster Unionist Party. So it was about, for me, it was about ground truth, community politic, engagement, and addressing the causes of conflict and the reasons for gross poverty in the area that I came from.
And you later became a member of Veterans for Peace. Motivated you to do that?
For me, it was just a natural evolution of the journey and the path that I was on. You know, I go back and I say, you know, I was this naive kid who worshipped at the high altar of violence, and I'd gone through this transition to being this peacenik who simply felt that violence was futile and could achieve nothing. And Veterans for Peace for me was my natural home where I could openly discuss who I was, the journey I had been on, but also related to being in the army amongst people who understood my language and who could speak to me. So for me, it was just a natural evolution to join Veterans for Peace.
You're still tuned into The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs around Ireland. I'm joined by our co-host, Michelle Gildernew, alongside our special guest, Glenn Bradley, who served in various regiments of the British Army and is now a member of Veterans for Peace.
Was there one particular event or one incident that sparked that desire to go from a combatant to somebody who promoted and worked towards peace?
Not that I can remember. I can't recall a singular catalytic moment. Obviously, the murder of my Uncle Louis and everything around that and my service in Bosnia, it bled heavily on me. But there's not a singular event that I can remember that made me go from this rather naive kid that had worshipped at the high altar of violence to being a peacenik. There's just nothing that is singularly correct. You know, I did five tours here And as you know, serving in Fermanagh is entirely different to serving in Belfast, and the duties that a soldier would have done at that time. But what I did identify with them was the belligerence of politicians of that era. And it really, really annoyed me because no one was addressing poverty. Nobody was addressing the causes of conflict. And what I mean by the causes of conflict is, you know, at that period of time, 1986 or whatever it was, I think we had, at that stage, there was probably about 16,000 Republicans and 10,000 Loyalists had been arrested, charged through the process and were in long cash. And, you know, something didn't happen in 1968 to suddenly make, you know, over 26,000 people wake up the next morning and go, we're violent and we're going to do this. Nobody was identifying the causes of conflict, which, in my opinion, also relates to the causes of poverty because they go hand in glove together. And I just had this desire and urge that, again, coming back to what I said earlier about my children, you know, I did not want them to inherit the socio-economic political basket case that I had been born into. And I felt a real duty and responsibility to address the causes of conflict and the reason why Northern Ireland was in such poverty. And that, even today, that remains my motivation. The only difference today is I'm now talking about my grandchildren. Mm-hmm. Because as you know, Michelle, there was things agreed in the Good Friday Agreement, things like the Bill of Rights and so on, that have never, ever been addressed because some politicians here don't want to.
I agree with you, and having been elected in 1998 into the First Assembly, I can tell you now that your worldview is very different from the vast majority of unionist politicians that I worked with, worked in committees, looked at tackling poverty. Some of the unionist politicians up there had no clue about poverty, how it existed, about how young people could end up homelessness. They were tone deaf to the actual problems that were facing our society.
I think a lot of that is to do with political unionism and what political unionism has been doing for the last 100 years from the creation of this state. You know, as McGrandy used to say, you know, up a shankle you could bring a donkey, traipse a union jack over it and would get elected. And that's what political unionism has been doing for 100 years. You know, back in 86, it was, 40 years ago, 60 years I was talking about. You know, nothing has changed. You know, people from outside the areas are parachuted into the areas and they get elected because of flag waving, because of things that are completely irrelevant to addressing the causes of poverty, the causes of undereducation within the unionist community. And it's an absolute disaster.
And this ethos, if you like, carried you in to business. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Well, it wasn't. Obviously, I had to work. When I joined the Ulster Unionist Party, it was a voluntary role. You know, you're not paid to be a constituency chairman. You're not paid as the treasurer. It was about activism, and it was about trying through the party to address things. So I always worked, and coming from a military background as I did, haulage and supply chains were naturally where I felt at home. So I formed a business in partnership with a guy. We were located in James's Business Park in Finglas, and we created a small cross-border haulage distribution company, and we went very quickly to making decent money.
Glenn, you're a few years older than me, but we basically want the same thing. We want a future for our children and grandchildren that's different to our upbringing. I can't ever envisage that within a six-county administration. How do you feel about how we move into the future in a way? The last 100 years, as you've pointed out, haven't been good for anybody. Society is broken here. I don't know, can it be fixed? But I don't see it ever been fixed within a six-county settlement. What's your views on that?
My view, you know, the Good Friday Agreement is our common denominator, Michelle. It's the common denominator of all the people in this region. You know, and when the people ratified the Good Friday Agreement, it became our mechanism for all political discourse.
Part
Within the Good Friday Agreement, there is the provisions for what people call a border poll, a referendum, that the people here, of their own vocation, can choose to stay in either the United Kingdom, or they can choose to go for something new. That's something new to me is personally more attractive than the current status quo. You know, and within me and my political journey, I think pre-Brexit, I was maybe happy to go along with things. But Brexit irreversibly, irrevocably proved to me that this small place that we call home is of no consideration to Westminster. Because political unionism, in my opinion, and keep in mind I come from that tribe, has utterly failed to deliver, to address anything for the last 100 years. The British government has failed to address anything in the last 100 years. And I just am at that stage of life where I'm going, what's to fear from trying something new? I don't fear change. You know, my whole life has been about embracing change and evolution. So for me, you know, if the border poll was happening tomorrow, I would be voting to end the union with Britain, and I would be voting to create something anew here in Ireland that is for all of the people of this island, all 2 million of us, that is equal, that delivers equitable equality, that addresses poverty, that addresses social housing needs, that addresses all the issues that for the last 100 years have not been addressed in this statement.
I think on that note, I want to thank you for coming in. It's great to have you today, and it's always good to see you.
Thank you.
This week, we take a look at the history of Crumlin Road Jail. While this Victorian-era prison has now been transformed into a public museum, its history is one embedded in the foundations of the state, one where the hangman was always busy.
Built in 1845, Crumlin Road Jail has borne witness to a fraught period of Irish history. In its 150 years, children from impoverished families, political prisoners, and suffragettes were among 25,000 people incarcerated within its walls. The first 106 inmates who were forced to walk from Carrickfergus prison in chains arrived in 1846. In a city where poverty was rife, children were often jailed for menial offences such as stealing food or clothing. 13-year-old Patrick McGee, who had been sentenced to 3 months in prison, hanged himself in his cell in 1858. That same year, a law was introduced forbidding children under the age of 14 to be sent to an adult prison. Women inmates were kept in the prison blockhouse until the early 1900s. Suffragettes among them, Dorothy Evans and Madge Muir, were imprisoned in the jail during 1914. Before the gallows was built in 1901, executions were carried out in full public view. An execution chamber was then constructed within the prison walls and used until the last of the hangings in 1961. 17 prisoners were executed in the prison, the last being Robert McLattery, who was hanged in 1961 for the murder of Pearl Gamble. The bodies of the executed were buried inside the prison in unconsecrated ground against the back wall beside the prison hospital. The execution of Tom Williams, a 19-year-old member of the IRA, took place on the 2nd of September 1942. He was hanged for the killing of an RUC officer. The hangman in charge was Thomas Pierpoint, the jail's most regular hangman, who carried out 6 executions in the jail between 1928 and 1942. After a long campaign by friends and comrades of Williams, he was disinterred and buried in Milltown Cemetery in the year 2000. Despite being known as Europe's Alcatraz, there were a number of successful escape attempts at the jail. The first recorded escape was in 1866. In May 1941, 5 Irish Republican prisoners made their escape over the walls of freedom. During its 150-year history, the jail had many prisoners pass through its doors. Some of the more well-known prisoners included former Irish Taoiseach Éamon de Valera, former Deputy First Minister Martin McGuinness and the hunger striker Bobby Sands. On the 24th of November 1991, during the last stages of the conflict,